Welcome back to the channel. My name is Seemland and today we're doing another Q&A. I know it's been a very long time since the last time we did this Q&A, but we're back with this right now. And if you want to ask me a question in the future, then make sure you follow me on Instagram. I'm doing the Q&A polls in the Instagram stories there.
Do it.
First question is about any updates to the True Diagnostics age speed test that I did a few months ago for my first test. The score for the speed of aging was 0.62, which is, yeah, like the one of the slowest in the world, and it actually would rank me at the Rejuvenation Olympics in the top leaderboard. Now, I need to wait 6 months from the first test to do the third test. You need 3 tests to categorize yourself into the Olympics, and that's the rules. And yeah, I still need to wait at least until mid-October for me to do the third test. Now, I did want to do the second test, but I actually had COVID in the meanwhile, short-term COVID, and I had an infection, and any kind of infection, whether that be COVID or whatever other type of sickness, illness, is going to mess up the results because your biological age has been seen to increase during the sickness and infection. So that's why I haven't done the second test yet. That will be, you know, worthwhile to do for the Olympic leaderboard. Yeah, I need to wait a little bit more, and I'm probably going to just do the second and the third test around the same time in October or the late September, somewhere around there. I definitely need to wait at least until October 13 or 14 to do the third test, but the second test I'll do probably a bit before that.
This episode is brought to you by Alitura Naturals. Alitura brings you the best natural skincare products for radiating skin and anti-aging. Regular skincare products are full of ingredients and fillers that actually cause more harm than good. Alitura uses only active ingredients sourced and handcrafted in Hawaii. Their products contain zero fillers. The Alitura Night Cream received the 2021 Clean Cert Beauty Awards for Best Face Cream. Alitura also has skin moisturizers, clay mask, serums, and cleansers. Head over to alitura.com and use the code SIIM, S-I-I-M, for a 20% discount.
Next question is, how much glycine would you need per kilogram of human weight? So, you know, I did make a recent video about the GlyNAC supplementation, glycine and NAC. So the combination of these supplements has been found to reverse hallmarks of human aging and improve many of the age-related outcomes like muscle strength, gait speed, cognitive function, and body composition. So it is actually one of the most proven human supplements in humans, in my opinion. Like, there's many other supplements that don't have pretty much any human data or human clinical evidence, but the GlyNAC combination apparently has actually, yeah, like multiple human studies, at least like 5 or 6 of them, that shows kind of the similar results. Now, those studies generally use around 100 milligrams of glycine per kilogram per day, and for NAC it's 98 milligrams per kilogram per day. So for me, I weigh 80 kilograms, then for me I would need 8 grams of glycine at least to get those benefits, and 7.8 grams of NAC. Of course, you know, you can even dispute that because I'm 29 years old and we don't know whether or not the GlyNAC supplementation would have any benefits for people my age. It certainly has benefits for the elderly people, because those individuals, the older you get, the lower your glutathione levels are going to be, which will then increase, you know, the oxidative stress and the inflammation and just overall burden on the system. Whereas if you're young, your glutathione levels and antioxidant defense levels are much higher, so we don't even know if it would, or there's no evidence to suggest that the GlyNAC would have any benefits for someone in their 20s or 30s. But you know, I do take it on some days, especially if, you know, you're about to catch a cold or something, then you can just take that and to support the glutathione and antioxidant defense system. Now, the issue with that dose is that you would actually need significantly more glycine than that. You know, the 7.8 grams of NAC per day is quite a lot. I haven't taken that large dose ever personally, but you know, it would probably be warranted for the elderly people if they're trying to raise their glutathione levels, because they see that 2.4 grams of glycine and NAC each doesn't raise glutathione in the elderly, but 4.8 and 7.2 grams does. So for the elderly, you do need a larger dose of glycine and NAC to see the effect on glutathione levels. whereas 2.8 grams or 2.4 grams, it doesn't appear to be enough to see that effect. So if you are trying to raise the glutathione with GlyNAC, then you need a moderate to high dose. So at least 4.8, 2, 7, even 8 grams of GlyNAC and of glycine and NAC each per grams. When it comes to glycine, then you actually need more because your body already requires 12 grams of glycine for the collagen turnover. Your body makes 3 grams every day itself, but the 3 grams are needed for covering the base requirement, so like a baseline requirement for glutathione synthesis, creatine synthesis, and heme synthesis, 3 grams. Now, the elderly people, or in certain disease states where your glutathione levels are low, like diabetes or metabolic syndrome, then you would need even more than that. Like, you would need significantly more glycine because, you know, 3 grams is for the, you know, baseline everyday requirement of glutathione. But if you're older or if you have a disease state, then your requirement for of glycine for the glutathione is probably, yeah, like 8 grams in that scenario, like for me, in my weight. For someone who is lighter weight, they might be have a slightly lower demand, but, you know, still like a higher amount of glycine and NAC is required for the glutathione requirement in a disease state or if you're older. Then there's still the 12 gram requirement for the collagen turnover. And the collagen turnover obviously is important for the skin anti-aging benefits, joint health, tendons, blood vessels, cardiovascular health. So, you know, your body makes 3 grams. You need at least 3 grams for the glutathione and creatine. If you're older or if you have diabetes or metabolic syndrome, then you need even more than that to cover the glutathione production. And then there's the 12 grams for the collagen turnover. Now, we don't necessarily know if the collagen turnover requires 12 grams of glycine or even up to 36 grams of glycine, because we don't know necessarily what's the glycine recycling rate. So if the glycine recycling rate is 95%, then yes, you need 12 grams for collagen turnover. But if it's 85%, like cysteines, then you would need, actually need, it's 85% like cysteine, then you would need 36 grams of glycine. So, you know, the demand for glycine can be quite large. And I think most people aren't getting the optimal amount of glycine. They're certainly not eating any foods that have significant amount of glycine. Like, the biggest sources of dietary glycine are like pork skin, pork rinds, chicken skin, fish skin, chicken tendons, ligaments, and, you know, gelatin. If you make the gelatin powder into the jello, you eat that as a dessert, then that's a really nice source of glycine. Around 28 grams of gelatin powder has only 5 grams of glycine still. So, you know, you need quite a lot of glycine for optimal health and optimal, like, anti-aging benefits, in my opinion. So you could need up to 15 grams at least. As a regular healthy person, if you have a certain disease state, then you might need even 20, 25 grams of glycine for both the collagen turnover and the glutathione synthesis. So yeah, I guess I hope that answers your question, how much you need per kilogram. You know, if you're looking for the glutathione, then that's 100 milligrams per kilogram of glycine and 98 milligrams per kilogram for NAC. But even on top of that, you still need additional glycine, at least 12 grams for the collagen turnover. And you could get that from a variety of sources. You could get it from dietary glycine sources, but it's pretty hard. Like, even 28 grams, so like 1 ounce of gelatin powder is 5 grams of glycine. And if you eat like some other foods that have glycine, like maybe some fish skin or chicken skin, then you're getting maybe 3 to 5 grams from that as well. And if you take like collagen peptides, so one serving of collagen peptides, 30 grams or something like that, generally, or 10 grams of collagen peptides is 3 grams of glycine. So if you're taking 30 grams of collagen peptides, then that's 10 grams of glycine. So yeah, you know, 30% of collagen is glycine. And most people still aren't meeting that, especially if they're not taking any collagen peptides or if they're not eating any collagenous proteins. So they would benefit from supplementing some glycine as well. Next question, how do you keep IGF-1 levels low? So this is, you know, relevant in terms of longevity. IGF-1, insulin like growth factor 1, it's part of the insulin IGF-1 signaling, and it is regulating pretty much like growth pathways. It regulates growth in the body. IGF-1 increases mTOR activity, so that's the growth switch in the body. High IGF-1 levels are associated with increased cancer and increased all-cause mortality because of pretty much getting cancer and accelerated aging. But the issue is that the IGF-1 level follows like a U-shaped curve. So low IGF-1 levels are also actually associated with increased mortality. Now, the, let's say, mechanism by which that could be is that either frailty and sarcopenia. So if you have too low IGF-1 levels, then you might be at a higher risk of hip fractures or just other forms of frailty. So you're able to, or you just fall on the ground and you break a hip and you're not able to recover. That applies especially to the elderly people. Or the other mechanism could also be that low IGF-1 levels, so you need IGF-1 actually to grow brain cells. So you need mTOR as well to grow brain cells. And too low IGF-1 levels might increase your risk of like neurodegeneration or some sort of other similar issues, or like dementia or Alzheimer's later in your life. So the sweet spot is somewhere in the middle from the perspective of the reference range. Then IGF-1 levels, the lowest risk is around 115 nanograms per milliliter up to like 300. And after 300, the mortality starts to increase. But below 100 is where also mortality is higher. My personal IGF-1 levels are actually like very low. The last test, it's the lowest it's ever been, is 78 nanograms per milliliter, which puts me into the higher risk category. Now, personally, am I worried about this? No. I actually personally believe that, yes, you know, the growth hormone and IGF-1 and insulin signaling pathway and the mTOR complex, they are pretty recognized to be related to aging and longevity. And many of these humans, even who have defects in growth hormone pathways, those people live longer. And I personally think that my low IGF-1 levels are safe, even based on the studies. That's where the higher mortality risk is. And the reason I think it's safe, because I have plenty of muscle. I'm above average, certainly in terms of muscle mass for my age, and even like all compared to other populations. So I have a ton of muscle for my height and my age. So I don't have any risk of sarcopenia or frailty. I lift weights. I have very high bone density. Now, in terms of the Alzheimer's side, then I'm not really worried about that either, because I'm not at a deficiency of growth. I obviously have plenty of growth signaling happening in my body, which is reflected by my muscle mass. So I don't really worry about those things. And I think that in my context, where I have good body composition and high muscle mass, high strength, and obviously, you know, I use my brain every day as well in a lot. So I don't have any risk for experiencing side effects from the low IGF-1 levels. So that's why I think it actually is pro-longevity. It actually slows down aging. That's pretty well known across all species and in humans as well. So how do you lower your IGF-1 levels? Well, obviously the most important thing is to make sure that you don't have obesity and you're not overweight. Being overweight generally is a sign that your body is overnourished and you are expressing the mTOR signaling. And if you have high insulin levels, your body has like a ton of excess energy, then that's a huge signal for the IGF-1 pathway to get activated as well. So if you have IGF-1 levels above 300 and you're overweight, then just losing weight is the most important thing that you can do to lower the IGF-1 levels. Other things that can also help with that is maintaining good glycemia. So insulin stimulates IGF-1 signaling. So making sure that you don't have hyperinsulinemia or hyperglycemia. So make sure that you improve your diet. Like, you know, how many carbs you should eat depends on people. I actually eat a lot of carbs as well. So I eat plenty of carbs. I might eat like 200 grams of carbs a day, which isn't low carb. It's not keto by any means. But my IGF-1 levels are still super low. And the reason why I'm able to do that is because I maintain a good weight. I exercise regularly. So I'm using the carbohydrates all the time. I'm never in like a surplus of carbohydrates, and I'm never in a surplus of blood glucose levels in that sense. Like my body doesn't experience hyperinsulinemia or hyperglycemia. My insulin levels are low, below 3, and my IGF-1 levels are low as well, which reflects that my body isn't experiencing energy excess, if that makes sense. My body fat percentage is low, and I'm just using all the energy I have. I'm in a calorie deficit most of the time. So yeah, that's why the IGF-1 levels are low. My body isn't experiencing excess, you know, energy and excess growth in that sense. All the calories I consume, all the carbohydrates I consume are used in a like appropriate way. And the last thing, the most powerful thing in my opinion, is actually intermittent fasting. So eating less than 3 meals a day is certainly one of the most powerful ways to reduce IGF-1 signaling, because like I said, I eat plenty of carbs. I actually eat a lot of protein as well. I don't eat like a ton of protein. I eat plenty of protein. I actually consume dairy as well, which is thought to stimulate IGF-1 signaling because of dairy supposed to make you grow. And it makes, you know, babies grow. It makes baby animals grow. So dairy is very insulinogenic and it has plenty of growth factors in it. So I eat dairy, I eat carbs, I eat protein, I eat meat. I don't eat like a ton of meat. But the point I'm trying to make is that I'm consuming all these foods that traditionally are associated with higher IGF-1 levels. And the reason I still have super low IGF-1 levels is because of doing intermittent fasting. So that's the most powerful strategy for reducing the IGF-1 levels. And I believe also affecting the aging pathways. And just because I eat twice a day, like I eat once a day, but I stimulate the growth pathways twice a day. So first in the around 11, 12 a.m., I'll consume like a protein shake. That is going to stimulate IGF-1 and mTOR. But after that, I work out. And after the workout, I'm going to have my dinner. So I'm only stimulating these pathways twice a day, which is pretty low compared to the average person who might do that 4 to 5 times a day, even 6 times a day or something like that. So if you're a bodybuilder who eats 6 times a day, high protein, high carb, high dairy, from the perspective of cottage cheese or whey protein or something like that, then those individuals will have higher IGF-1 levels because they're stimulating this growth multiple times a day. But I eat the same foods pretty much. Of course, I'm not eating as many calories, but because I'm doing that only twice a day and the first signal is actually very weak, it just has 25 to 30 grams of protein in the protein shake, then because of that, my IGF-1 levels are low. And of course, combine that with the lower body fat percentage and calorie restriction. So that's the effective way to reduce IGF-1 levels. If you don't want to do a lot of intermittent fasting, like you want to still eat 3 meals a day, then yes, you would want to reduce the foods that stimulate IGF-1, like dairy or meat or carbohydrates. And if you're staying like lower carb and eating more plant-based, then that will also reduce your IGF-1 levels. So like a high carb, no animal meat vegan, even if they eat 3 meals a day, their IGF-1 levels would be around 100 because they don't have the methionine and leucine primarily in that you get from animal protein, and that would also keep their IGF-1 levels low. But if you eat a lot of dairy and carbs and protein 3 to 4 times a day, then that's going to raise the IGF-1 levels, if that makes sense. Next question, with cooking meat, how do you make sure that you're not getting too many AGEs? So AGEs are these advanced glycation end products, and these let's say molecules are associated with accelerated aging and they can cause damage to the collagen. AGEs are actually the number one thing that damages your collagen scaffolding and structure, so they're going to cause wrinkles essentially, and they are also associated with accelerated aging and diabetes and neurodegeneration and cardiovascular disease. So these AGEs they're not like good molecules. Some people might say that yes, you can eat charred food and it's fine. You know, I believe that, I mean, in moderation is fine. Your body can handle a certain amount of oxidative stress. Your body can handle a certain amount of AGEs and a certain amount of acrylamide, which is the same thing, but in the form that you get from starchy carbohydrates. And your body can handle even a certain amount of oxidized fats, oxidized canola oil, whatever. It's just a dose that becomes the kind of detrimental thing. After a certain tipping point, after which your body's antioxidant defense system isn't able to counteract these molecules, then they become seriously harmful. So how do you reduce the AGEs? AGEs primarily form if you cook proteins, first and foremost, if you overcook animal protein, and especially if you combine it with certain carbohydrates. So glycation refers to the glucose component and carbohydrates. Now there's also like advanced lipid end products. So if you overcook fatty meat, then you're going to form these advanced lipid end products, which are equally as bad generally. So the way you reduce that is, you know, you make sure that you don't char the meat. So the dark spots on the meat that come from barbecue and grilling and high temperature cooking, those are the AGEs. These are these heterocyclic amines, as they're called. These are the AGE components that are not good. They're going to promote wrinkles and might contribute to some other age-related issues and certainly accelerate aging from the biological side. So making sure that you don't over-fry the meat. You don't overcook it and you don't char it completely. Like the dark spots are pretty much the issue where the issue is at. But there's also like ways to, you know, even if it does become higher temperature and even if it becomes somewhat charred, you can use certain compounds to mitigate the AG formation. So rosemary, thyme, different kinds of herbs, spices, they all have anti-glycative effects, so they can reduce the formation of AGEs. So whenever you are cooking steak or whatever food, you're just using high temperature, even if you're doing stir fry with vegetables and rice, I would always add certain herbs to there, like rosemary is the most powerful one and the most known, most common herb that has these anti-glycation effects. And you should add herbs to pretty much all your meals. Like, why not? They have just such a wide variety of benefits. Like, they're going to have this anti-AGE effects. They're going to protect against the oxidation of lipids and fats as well. They're going to suppress CD38, which is the inflammatory molecule that reduces your NAD levels. And they also, these herbs also stimulate autophagy. They help to lower blood sugar levels. So I don't see a reason why you wouldn't want to add like a ton of herbs to your meals. Now, the other components that can also help with that are, you know, the fat, obviously, that you use to cook with. If you are cooking with very fragile fats that become very easily oxidized, like canola oil or, you know, I mean, olive oil is also fragile in the sense that it's has a lower smoking point, but because olive oil generally has a high amount of polyphenols, then the polyphenols protect against the oxidation of the fat. So it protects against the olive oil. So if you have high polyphenol extra virgin olive oil, then that's safe to cook with, actually. And it does protect against the AGE formation. So olive oil is generally a good fat to cook with. I wouldn't still stir fry it. But, you know, if you're just cooking any kind of food at a lower temperature, then olive oil is perfectly fine. You know, obviously, turmeric and other kinds of spices have similar effects as the herbs. And lastly, you can also use glycine. Glycine lowers blood sugar, actually protects against AGE formation and reduces the side effects of these AGEs. So that's the kind of main, you know, order of operation. Don't overcook or don't char the meat completely dark. You can add herbs and spices. Rosemary, turmeric, cook it in olive oil or some other high polyphenol oil, and you can also take glycine to counteract that. Next question, your top 10 supplements. So I have made, you know, obviously a lot of videos about my supplements. I also have my supplement list, so my own personal supplement stack that I take. You can check it out at seemlan.co/supplement-list. Is the website where you can get the PDF for my own personal supplements and when I take them in what amounts, etc. But what I would say is the top 10 supplements, you know, obviously number one, glycine, number two, NAC, number three, creatine, number four, I like niacinamide or nicotinamide, so because that regulates the salvage pathway of NAD recycling. I think that's vastly underrated. NAD booster is certainly cheaper than NMN as well. Number five would be TMG, trimethylglycine, because it has pretty nice effects for exercise performance, and it also is obviously important for methylation. Number six, I would say melatonin. Like, I'm actually still a huge fan of melatonin. Melatonin as a hormone is obviously super important for anti-aging and longevity, besides just sleep. As a supplement, I think melatonin is a safe sleep aid in certain situations. If you take it at a smaller dose, so I take usually like 0.1 to 0.3 milligrams of melatonin, not every night, but pretty regularly. Then number seven, I would say I like glucosamine because it is anti-inflammatory. It has autophagy regulating effects. It has cardiovascular disease protective effects. And, you know, there is at least a few studies. There are observational studies, but regardless, glucosamine use being associated with reduced all-cause mortality and reduced cardiovascular disease mortality. And glucosamine is obviously important for the joints as well. So I have a very preventive approach to taking supplements. I want to take supplements that have like preventive effects mostly in my age when I don't have any, you know, age-related conditions or any chronic diseases. Number eight is a supplement that I just personally, anecdotally have seen to work very good, which is HMB. So it's a byproduct of leucine, And the biggest effect of taking HMB, what I've noticed, is that it helps to retain muscle mass when I'm doing a little bit of fasting. And it has a positive effect on my body composition when I'm taking it. So that it only works for me because I'm eating at a very small time frame. And I don't want to have, you know, I don't want to have multiple meals per day. It just doesn't suit my lifestyle and doesn't suit my, you know, like just work routine. It kind of wouldn't be the most preferable way for me to eat, to have multiple meals. So that's why I'm taking HMB in the morning in a fast state to reduce the muscle catabolism that would occur if I'm doing like a longer fast. If I were to eat breakfast, then I wouldn't see any benefits of taking HMB. And when in other studies, in other clinical trials, they find the HMB doesn't really work if the protein intake is matched and the calorie intake is matched. What they do find is that HMB works in the elderly people who are at a higher risk of sarcopenia. Hence, why I see as well benefits when I'm taking it while fasting. So obviously I'm not old, I don't have sarcopenia, but the thing is, yeah, like in a small eating window, as with 1 meal a day or 2 meals a day, then I personally see a benefit of taking HMB. It might not work for anyone else who is eating like breakfast or other multiple meals. Number 9 supplement is collagen. So I take collagen every day, and it's a good source of glycine. But the reason I'm taking collagen is also that, you know, it actually just reflects what the clinical trials say, that the collagen peptides, the small amino acid chains in the collagen, is what has these anti-aging benefits for the skin and reduces hallmarks of skin aging and promotes skin longevity. So based on the evidence, then the collagen peptides work, whereas we don't have, you know, any evidence that the gelatin powder would work, for example, although it does contain some collagenous amino acids and glycine as well. So I take the collagen peptides based on the evidence that we have, that it's the collagen peptides, the small amino acid chains, that have those skin longevity benefits. And lastly, number 10 is hyaluronic acid. So this is another skin, let's say, compound that also improves skin hydration and skin moisturization. There's actually some solid evidence in humans as well that it does have those benefits for the skin. So I do take it pretty much every day. Next question, how you started building up your dreams? So I guess I haven't really framed or outlined what are my goals with this channel and my like personal brand. So obviously I'm interested in longevity, I'm interested in anti-aging and life extension. Like I do want to support extending human lifespan as much as possible. I don't think we're going to become immortal, but I do believe that, you know, we can add a few extra years to the average life expectancy over the course of the next few decades. And, you know, who knows what's going to happen eventually. But, you know, what I'm trying to do with this brand and my, all my work is to eventually create like a system or just a brand or whatever kind of methodology to support people to have better access to better healthcare and just better access to better medical care and better access to longevity care, is kind of, you know, preventive health. Like, obviously governments do not the best job in a lot of ways, but I just want to, yeah, like educate people to learn how to live better, live healthier, live longer with all the different kinds of methods, like traditional healthcare, biohacking, just traditional healthy living and those kind of things. So that's kind of my goal. And how did I start building towards that? Obviously, I've been doing this channel for many years. Like I've been actually doing YouTube videos since 2017, so 6 years. It's been very long. I've you know, I started at a very amateur level. I didn't know what I was doing. I just started making videos, started making content about different topics. My topics have evolved over the course of this time. Obviously, I personally have evolved over this time. I've learned new things, I've changed some of the things, but yeah, I've just started creating YouTube videos about biohacking generally. And actually before that I started making blog posts, but yeah, in 2017 is where the YouTube channel started. And since then I've written multiple books about health, and by now I've written like 8 books. I'm in the process of writing my 9th book. It's gonna be about longevity. It's gonna come out probably the end of 2023 or early 2024. So yeah, I mean, it's a very long journey that I have ahead of me. And yeah, that's what I'm generally doing and focused on right now. Next question, best fast to lose fat and gain muscle at the same time. So I think the best fasting window for losing fat and improving body composition is generally going to be like the 16-8 method. So you just fast 16 hours, eat generally two meals, maybe two meals and a snack or something like that. That's the easiest way. It's going to confine your eating window in a way that makes it easy to stick to a calorie deficit. But yeah, obviously you want to make sure that you get enough protein and you also train and lift weights, because otherwise if you just lose weight without lifting weights, then you might just lose muscle tissue in the process. So the key to positive body recomposition, so losing fat and gaining muscle, or just maintaining muscle at a maximum rate, then for that you need to lift weights, be in a calorie deficit, and eat a higher protein intake. If you're not in a calorie deficit, you don't need that much protein actually. You're better off getting more carbohydrates, based on my experience and the research as well, that you know, your protein becomes increasingly more important the lower your calorie intake is, to compensate for the calorie deficit in terms of lean body mass retention. So you don't need a ton of protein if you're in a calorie surplus, or if you're even at calorie maintenance. If you're in calorie deficit, then you might need a bit more protein. But the fasting window is there just to help you to stick to the calorie deficit and make it easy to stick to the diet, if that makes sense. Next question, does the weight gain from creatine stop with continued use? So creatine, when you start taking it, the weight gain you might see primarily comes from water retention. And that water retention it's not this bloat as you would see from water retention from just gaining weight or gaining fat. The creatine, what it does is that it makes your muscles hold on to more water. So it actually is positive weight gain, like your muscles soak up more water and glycogen and they look more fuller, and that might increase the number on the scale as well. So I wouldn't really worry about seeing an increase in your weight if you start taking creatine, because that weight gain is muscle or the water inside the muscles. It's more soaked up off water. After a while, obviously it's going to hit a plateau after a certain point. It's not going to progressively increase the longer you take creatine. It's just your body will saturate the creatine stores in the muscles and saturate the muscle, or saturate the water inside the muscle as well. So it does stop after a certain point. Like if you take 5 grams of creatine every day for 5 months, then it's not going to increase from day one up until 5 months. It probably saturates after a few weeks of use, and then it kind of stops and then plateaus there. And then once you stop taking creatine, then you will generally lose some of the water inside the muscle as well. So, you know, it's not fat gain, it's not, you know, weight gain in a traditional sense, it's just water being soaked up in the muscle. And the last question of the Q&A is, when to take melatonin? So it depends why you're taking it. If you're taking it for sleep, then you want to take it like an hour or two before bed. I personally take it like 1 hour before bed. I take 0.1, 0.3 milligrams of melatonin for sleep purposes before bed. And then you should already have higher amounts of melatonin once you fall asleep. And you obviously want to support that with the blue blocking glasses and dimming down the lights in your bedroom. So you don't want to be, you know, taking melatonin, the supplement, and then you're still surrounded by super artificial and bright lights. It kind of defeats the purpose. So you want to take melatonin 1 hour before bed, dim down the lights, put on the blue blockers, and then go to sleep in 1 hour after that. If you are taking melatonin for the immune system benefits, and if you are suffering from some infection, then they actually use melatonin during the daytime as well. Like they take larger doses, like 3 to 10 milligrams even. So I personally haven't done that. I don't think that it's kind of needed. I would take just a higher dose of melatonin before bed if it were up to me, because you don't really want to disrupt the natural melatonin cycle. Like your body makes melatonin only in the evening and when you're sleeping. It doesn't produce any melatonin during daytime unless you're in a cave, like unless you're not surrounded by any light at all. Then your body does start to produce melatonin even if it's daytime, but you know, I personally wouldn't mess with the circadian system, because in the long term it can lead to some circadian disruption. So even if you're sick, you're trying to use melatonin for the immune system benefits and anti-inflammatory benefits, then even then I would take the melatonin like 1 hour before bed. And in that case, you can take like a larger dose, 3 to 5 milligrams. All right, that's it for this Q&A. Make sure you follow me on Instagram at Seemlund if you want to get your question asked in the future. But do you want to slow down aging and live longer? If yes, then I'm looking for more people who want to reverse their biological clock. If you're interested, then email me the word health to info@seemlund.com and I'll send you the details. But other than that, thanks for watching this video. Make sure you click a like, subscribe, notification bell as well. My name is Seem. Stay optimized, stay empowered.